Thanks for being with us on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. Our guest is John Lott, the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. They're online at crimeresearch.org. And Mike calls in from Anaconda, Montana. Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
We're well.
Okay, I guess I got a question. I was in the military. I served in the Army for about 6 years, served in Iraq, 0304. And I live in Montana, and about one point in time, they diagnosed me with mild to moderate PTSD. Now, I guess the question is hunting is a way of life here, and it's more of a tool and not a weapon. Is a hunting rifle in the category that, like, you cannot own anything at all if you're diagnosed with that?
Right. Well, one can only guess right now exactly what it's going to be, but it's going to be largely, it looks like, up to the discretion of the mental health expert that you're going to be seeing. And so, but if you have mental illness, your name can be put in the registry that they're going to have. And if once it's there, it would have implications for your ability to go and buy a gun. Now they're not going to come and take away the guns that you already have, presumably, but they could make it so you can't buy a new gun.
Right. Yeah, that was just kind of mainly my question, and thanks for taking my call. Everything just seems so weird, and the directions everything's going in, it's just kind of like a giant tornado, and that was my question. Thanks for answering that.
Absolutely. You bet, Mike.
Thanks. You know, they have something else with regard to mental issues that you and I have talked about a while ago, and that is, he's directing the Social Security Administration to go and look at the beneficiaries to see whether or not they should be prohibited for mental health reasons from having a gun. And at least the documents that have come out before indicate that they are going to primarily be modeling after what they've done for the veterans, where they've gone and said if a veteran has somebody else helping take care of their finances, which is basically in many cases, older veterans. So the example I have is my mom, who's in her 80s. She has given my sister power of attorney to go and take care of paying her bills. My mom, who's in her 80s, she can't deal with computers at all. You know, she gets explained to her. She forgets it. She has, like, no patience, no desire to go and deal with computers. But just because somebody can't go and deal with computers, does that mean that they're mentally defective, as the term that the administration wants to go and use on this? Does it tell us anything about their ability to go and defend themselves? I don't see what the two have to do with each other. And unfortunately, I think it's just an example of the administration kind of reaching for things as just an excuse to reduce the number of people who own guns. A general point I should make here, and that is, these background checks are costly. Jim, you're sitting in Washington, D.C. right now. If somebody in Washington, D.C. wants to transfer a gun, it costs $125 to do that. Now, that may not stop Jim or myself from being able to go and get a gun, but my research tells me that the people who benefit the most are law-abiding, poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas in some not-too-nice places in D.C., and $125 kind of additional fee tacked on top of the regular cost of buying a gun may make a difference for some of them, whether or not they can afford the chance to go and protect themselves and their families or not.
1-866-50-JIMBO, something to keep in mind as we continue our discussion with John Lott. Just to amplify on these various points the president brought out, the background checks, what are they changing, and what is it supposed to do with background checks?
Right. Well, right now, if you go and you buy a gun any place in the country, you buy it from a dealer, you go to a shop, somebody who's a federally licensed dealer, you have to have the purchase go through a background check. They call up the federal government. There's a computer that runs it, and they go and they see whether or not you have any felony convictions, felony arrests in which the penalty would be more than 2 years, any misdemeanor convictions that you have, and whether you have been, let's for example, involuntarily committed for mental illness issues. If you have any of those things, then you'll be forbidden from being able to go and buy a gun. And if you didn't fill out the form correctly and acknowledge on the form that you had those issues, then you will have committed perjury and they will, you know, you could get prosecuted and sent to jail for 3 years for doing that. Now, in addition, there's 18 states that have what they call background checks on private transfers. And so these are transfers between you and your neighbor or a son or somebody else that you may know. In 32 of the states, you don't have to, you can just sell it to the person. In the other 18 states, you have to go and go to a dealer, have to find a licensed firearms dealer, and have them kind of physically take the gun out of your hands, run a background check, and then give it to the person who you want to sell it to, or even loan it to. You have to go, you know, if somebody wants to borrow your shotgun for the weekend, you're going to have to go to the licensed firearms dealer and have them conduct a background check so they can go and take it from you and give it to this other person to go and use for the weekend. And so, you know, and the question is, what the president would like to do on this is to essentially define everybody as having the characteristics, or just about everybody that he can, as having the characteristics that would be necessary to make them have to become licensed firearms dealers if they were to sell the gun. And so they would be legally obligated then to go and do the background check before. So if you're going to sell it to your neighbor and you meet any of these criteria that you have, so you've had the gun for 5 months and you decide you want to sell it to your neighbor, then you, if you don't get a license, and if you don't go, and by the way, getting a license can take at least a year, and it's costly, and it, a lot of forms, and it's a hassle, and you got to go and get interviewed a couple times. But once you've done that, then you can, when you're going to give it to your neighbor, you go and get a number, you'll call up, and a computerized search would be done on your neighbor, and then you could go and give him the gun. And that's what the president would like to have happen.
Stay with us. More to come. 1-866-50-JIMBO with John Lott on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show. We're talking about the president's tearful announcement of various executive actions that he plans to take regarding gun control. John Lott, our guest tonight. He is the president at crimeresearch.org, and plenty of calls. I just note some of the things here that, for example, some local jurisdictions have said that their restrictions did not violate the Second Amendment, but in McDonald versus Chicago back in 2010, the Supreme Court said, yes, it does, that localities and states do not have the option of violating the Constitution either. And then again, there's also the question of whether the president may, in fact, be violating the Administrative Procedure Act, which mandates that proposed right. actions be made available to the public for comment before becoming effective. Now, this may seem like nitpicking lawyer talk, but it's the law, and these are things that have to be considered here.
Right. No, I mean, to be honest, there's lots of issues here that are going to, I was just trying to give a very simple one earlier by just quoting the statute and just say, how can anybody argue that this is their principal objective of their job, you know, if they sell one gun? It just, you know, but I agree with you. There's other, I'm sure somebody could list out 20 possible reasons to go and bring a case against them, and there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that it's going to be litigated.
Yeah. Let's talk to Bob in Abington, Illinois. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening. I just have one comment about this, and that is that the Founding Fathers, when they made the Second Amendment, they were very particular about their wording. They used the word infringed. And if you look up the word infringed, I don't see how any law that they passed could stand up in court.
Right. Well, when I used to teach in law schools, I would ask my students sometimes, okay, so the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no laws. And I'd say, okay, what would they have had to write in the First Amendment to really mean it? Because the Supreme Court says, well, what the way they interpret it is Congress shall pass no laws unless they have a really good reason for it. So if, what would they have had to write if they really meant Congress shall pass no laws abridging freedom of speech and what have you? Would they have had to write Congress shall never, ever, ever? I mean, how many no's do they have to put in there until the courts would say, okay, we get it, you mean no laws? And, you know, obviously infringe is a very strong word there too. I mean, how would they have had to write it in order to have it so that there wouldn't be restrictions on it? So, you know, and we can go and talk about that, but it's...
I think their intent here was for no laws to be passed on the Second Amendment. I don't know about the others.
Right. No, I'm just saying it's a similar question that's there. Here's the deal with judges. I've hung around judges a lot over my life, and people like to be in the middle of things. They like to have their policy preferences involved. And so if you have really bright lines that, you know, says Congress shall not do such and such, then, you know, if they do it, then there's not much of a legal decision. You say, well, you did it. It says you're not supposed to do it. End of story. But if they can go and have something where it says, you shouldn't do this unless you have a really good reason for doing it, then somebody has to judge whether it's a really good reason for doing it. And so, and then the judges can get in and, you know, this is a case that they can get excited about and interested in. It gives them something to do. It increases the power of judges to have kind of blurry lines rather than bright lines. When they wrote the original Constitution, they tried as hard as they could to create bright lines. But over time, those lines have been muddied because, you know, people have it in their interest, I believe, to go and have more power.
Let's go to Richard in Dallas, a listener to Cliff Radio. Good evening, Richard. Hello, Richard. Well, perhaps we don't have Richard at the moment. We'll take a break and be back with more in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show with John Lott of the Crime Prevention Research Center and Richard in Dallas. Hello, Richard.
Yes, Jim and Jimbo. Happy New Year to you, gentlemen.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Yes. The question I have is this, and I was motivated to ask this question after I had a conversation with a friend of mine who's from Ethiopia. He was asking me about this new gun control laws from Obama, and I said I'm against it. And then I asked him, well, he says, well, we don't have guns in Ethiopia. Nobody has any guns. I go, what's going on in Ethiopia? It's different from America. And what's going on in Ethiopia, he told me, was, well, there's no racism. Like, everybody's black over there. We don't have the racism that we have here. So,
right. I think Jim was laughing because of the claim that there are no guns in Ethiopia.
Yeah, Ethiopia's been the site of some tremendous violence over the years.
Well,
and in terms of no racism, obviously your friend is a little bit on the stupid side on both sides of that equation. There's racism everywhere.
Well, tribalism, for sure.
But if he really believes there are no guns in Ethiopia, he hasn't been there in a while.
Well, maybe I got the country wrong. Anyway, the question is, what part does racism play in all the gun crimes we have in America? Racism.
Well, you know, it's the vast majority of violent crime is within race. You know, so you have whites generally kill whites, Asians kill Asians, Hispanics kill Hispanics, blacks kill blacks. That's overwhelmingly what happens. People hang around people who are similar to them generally. I mean, maybe that's racism to some extent. People like to be with people who are similar. And so, you know, the criminals are hanging around with the same people too, and they tend to kill or rape or rob people who are similar to them.
So Jim, it's not race to one race against another. It's within the race, and if it's within races mostly, is it then economic, lower income versus higher income?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of work that's been done by economists and criminologists over time to explain who commits crime, and changes in income really don't explain more than about 1% or so of the variation in crime rates. There are other things that are much more important, such as the likelihood that you're going to get caught in different areas, and that whether it's cultural, whether people turn in people to police when bad things that happen, you know, a lot of that. And, of course, drugs and drug gangs and the chance to go and make money from drugs. I mean, just like, you know, a lot of people don't know that the highest murder rate we ever had was the last year of Prohibition, okay? And after it was ended, murder rates within about 2 years had fallen by about 60%. And we've had high murder rates since there, but a lot of the violent crime that we have in the United States is either directly or indirectly related to drug gangs. I mean, you have 75% of the murders in the United States take place in fewer than 3% of the counties. And if you have a crime map of Washington, D.C., or any other major city, it's not like the murders are evenly spread out in those places. They're very heavily concentrated in a few places, and a lot of that is our drug gangs fighting against each other to control drug turf. And as the price of drugs go up, they fight more than they would have otherwise.
No, those are your main factors there, Richard. But your friend is a little short on proper information as regarding the role of racism, as John notes. Yeah, overwhelmingly, we are not equal opportunity when we kill. We tend to kill people of our own race, and the murder rate, as John noted, is heavily, I mean intensely, concentrated in a very few areas of the country. And what we're seeing from the administration here is essentially an effort to thrash about and pretend to solve a problem that really does not have an answer. In terms of shaping the future of gun safety technology, we're talking about various ways to make it difficult for people who don't own a gun to use a gun and the like. Are those useful tools, John?
Not at this point, and there are a couple problems with it. One is, I mean, the one that's marketed right now is you have a little radio transmitter as a watch, essentially, on your wrist, and it has to be within a few feet of the gun because the signal is very weak. The problem with that is you can have radio jamming technology that could stop it. Police would refuse to use that because if criminals ever, you know, had the radio jamming frequencies that were there, the police would be unarmed. And besides that, it's amazingly expensive. You look at the guns that use that right now, it's like $1,800. And so my concern would be the very people that you would price out of being able to go and own a gun are the people who, in fact, need guns the most for self-defense, the poor people who live in these high-crime areas that we were just talking about there. There's no way they're going to be able to afford $1,800 for a handgun that's going to be there. And so, you know, and these other types of things, like the president was talking about fingerprint readers or whatever, that hasn't really worked out too well. And one of the big problems with it is the concussion that you have when you pull the trigger on a gun. That shock doesn't do good things to sensitive electrical, you know, circuitry that's there. And so, you know, maybe they could do things to harden it, what have you, but of course then you're just talking about making it even more expensive. And so, and if you pull it enough times, if you do, you know, 1,000 rounds, you don't really want to go and have to replace major parts of the electronics on the guns just because you've gone out for a few weekends to go and do target shooting. So, I mean, it's not, those are the two big problems, the cost and also and reliability.
Fair enough. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. Again, we're looking at the president's efforts to, again, go around Congress, and the constitutionality of much of what he's talking about is certainly going to be in question in the courts. And as we have noted, the practicality as well. John Lott is president at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org, and a worthwhile website to read, I might add. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One.